Everything went well for a few days, when suddenly the false rumor was spread that the Persian emperor had died. This resulted in riots, whereby several Persian soldiers were killed. Even so, Nadir Shah forbade reprisals. On the morning of 20th March 1739, he rode through the streets of the city to personally assess the situation. When a few Delites were reckless enough to throw stones at him, and one even fired a musket, killing a Persian officer right by the Shah's side, his reply was to order a general massacre. The slaughter continued all day long, with thousands of people, most sources estimate the number of slain at about 30,000, butchered like cattle in their homes and in the streets. Dirk Collier, The Great Mughals and Their India. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to Season 10 of the Islamic History Podcast. This season, we are continuing our discussion on the Mughal Empire. This is Episode 10-2, The Persian. Delhi's history begins with the ancient city of Indraprastha, believed to be the capital of the Pandavas from the Indian epic, the Mahabharata, dating back to around 3000 BCE. Archaeological evidence suggests that the area was inhabited since the 2nd millennium BCE, with settlements like the Mauryan city of Pataliputra influencing the region. Delhi transformed into a significant center of power during the medieval period. The Tamara Rajputs founded the city of Lal Kot in the 8th century, which was later conquered by the Chauhans. Prithviraj Chauhan, the last Hindu ruler, was defeated in 1192 by Muhammad Ghori, leading to the establishment of the Delhi Sultanate. This era saw Delhi emerge as a thriving hub of culture, trade, and architecture. The Sultanate period, particularly under rulers like Qutbuddin Aibak, Iltutmish, and Alauddin Khilji, left a lasting legacy with the construction of monumental structures like the Qutub Minar, the Ali Darwaza, and the Hauz Khas complex. The Tughlaq dynasty further fortified the city with notable constructions like the Tughlaqabad Fort. In 1526, Babur defeated the Sultan of Delhi, Ibrahim Lodi, at the Battle of Panipat, marking the beginning of the Mughal Empire. Under the Mughals, particularly during the reigns of Akbar, Jahangir, and Shah Jahan, Delhi flourished as an imperial capital. Shah Jahan, in particular, is credited with the construction of Shah Jahanabad, the seventh city of Delhi, which included the magnificent Red Fort and Jama Masjid. The city became synonymous with Mughal grandeur, intricate gardens, bustling bazaars, and grand mosques. Nadir Shah. The Rise of the Afsharid Dynasty. The Mughal and Safavid empires were founded around the same time. The Safavids began in 1501 with the conquest of Azerbaijan, while the official beginning of the Mughal Empire was 25 years later in 1526 at the Battle of Panipat. Shah Ismail I had supported Babur during his many failed attempts to conquer Samarkand. A generation later, Babur's son, Humayun, took refuge in Iran with Shah Ismail's son, Tamasp. For the details on these events, go ahead and listen to Season 8. And despite a minor dispute over Herat, the Mughals and Safavids generally maintained a cordial relationship. In 1708, during the reign of Shah Hussein, the Ghilzai Afghans in Herat rebelled against Safavid rule. The Afghans eventually invaded Isfahan in Persia and forced Shah Hussein to abdicate the throne in 1722. During this chaos, Russia and the Ottomans captured significant portions of Iranian territory. Nadir Kuli Beg, a Safavid army commander and a Khorasan Turk, rallied the Persians against these invasions. He supported Shah Hussein's son, Shah Tamasp, who appointed him deputy in 1729. This turned out to be a mistake, as Nadir Kuli Beg deposed Shah Tamasp 3 years later. Nadir Kuli Beg then placed Shah Tamasp's infant son Abbas on the throne and declared himself the child's infant. 4 years later, in 1736, Nadir Kuli Beg deposed the young Shah, this time declaring himself Shahin Shah of Persia. This was the end of the Safavid dynasty and the beginning of the Afshari dynasty. From that point onward, Nadir Kuli Beg would be known as Nadir Shah. In 1737, Nadir Shah invaded the Arabian Gulf Coast and he conquered Bahrain and Oman. Then, in 1738, he invaded Herat and defeated the rebellious Ghilzai Afghans. Nadir Shah then sent an envoy to the Mughal court requesting they seal the borders and turn back any fleeing Afghan rebels. Nadir Shah planned to attack Kandahar and didn't want any Afghans launching cross-border attacks on his forces. However, the Mughal response was very nonchalant and evasive. Emperor Muhammad Shah Rangila, or someone acting on his behalf at least, merely promised to send instructions to Kabul. Nadir Shah was not satisfied with this response, so he sent a second envoy to the Mughals. This envoy also failed to secure any guarantees from the Mughal emperor. And indeed, when Nadir Shah began his siege of Kandahar, hundreds of Afghans fled into Mughal-controlled Kabul. Persian forces pursued the rebels to the border, but Mughal forces did not cooperate in handing them over. Furious, Nadir Shah sent yet a third envoy to Delhi. This time, he demanded to know why the Mughals were allowing the rebels into their territory and insisted they be turned over. But Emperor Muhammad Shah Rangila and his courtiers were too busy partying and drinking to deal with the issue. In fact, the Persian envoy was placed under house arrest so he wouldn't disturb the emperor's fun. Two additional envoys received the same dismissive treatment. The Persian invasion. Nadir Shah was furious and prepared to attack the Mughals due to their lack of response. Nasir Khan, the governor of Kabul, had no means to stop the invasion because he didn't have the funds to pay his troops. Even after the emperor, that is the Mughal emperor, punished Koki Bi, his milk sister, for embezzlement, financial support to Kabul did not start back up. Kani Duran, one of those corrupt individuals the emperor liked to hang with, was the Mir Bakshi, or the army paymaster, for the Mughal Empire. He dismissed the governor's pleas for help in Kabul and even ridiculed him. Historically, Kabul was always considered a vital province for the Mughals. Every Mughal emperor up to Bahadur Shah understood its importance in defending their western front. However, Kabul became less of a priority under Muazzam Shah and even more so under the Sayyid brothers. Muhammad Shah Rangila neglected Kabul because he was too busy being Rangila, the playboy. On November 14, 1738, Nadir Shah launched his attack, easily defeating the diminished and weakened Mughal forces in Kabul. From Kabul, the Persians moved on to Peshawar, which also fell to Nadir Shah. Back in Delhi, Emperor Muhammad Shah, that is Rangila, assumed that tribal Afghans at Khyber Pass would stop the Persians. But just like the troops in Kabul, the Afghans had also not received their payments. When the Persians came through, the Afghans joined with them instead. Zakaria Khan, the governor of Punjab, knew he was next and prepared his defenses as best he could. Then he nervously waited for the emperor to send reinforcements. But no reinforcements ever came. After a brief skirmish with the Punjabi troops, Nadir Shah entered Lahore on January 10, 1739. Nadir Shah demanded 2 million rupees or he'd sack the city. Now that he was satisfied that Lahore was under his control, Nadir Shah allowed Zakaria Khan to remain on as governor, but now he was governor under Nadir Shah. With both Kabul and Lahore under his control, Nadir Shah moved on to Delhi. Now, finally, after losing two cities, Emperor Muhammad Shah Rangila got serious about the Persian threat. He quickly assembled an army, which included Nizam al-Mulk of Hyderabad and Sa'adat Khan of Awadh. The emperor also sent messages asking for support from the Rajputs and Marathas, but they responded with small contingents. And now, with his army assembled, the emperor led them to face off against the Persians. Nadir Shah's army had set up camp at Ganjpura, just outside of Delhi. And the fighting started on February 14, 1739. The hastily gathered Mughal army was not ready for Nadir Shah's experienced and disciplined troops. The Mughals didn't even bring their artillery with them, and they were soon overwhelmed by the Persians. During the fighting, Sa'adat Khan, the Nawab of Awadh, was captured, and the Persians decided to use him as a negotiator on their behalf. It should be known, Sa'adat Khan was a Shiite, just like the Persians were. The next day, the Emperor and Nizam-ul-Mulk met with Nadir Shah at the Persian camp. They negotiated an agreement where Nadir Shah would leave with a Mughal payment of 20 million rupees. Kani Duran, the Emperor's corrupt Grand Vizier, was injured during the fighting and he eventually died. After the negotiations with the Persians, Muhammad Shah Rangila appointed Nizam-ul-Mulk's son as the new Grand Vizier. But this angered Sa'adat Khan, remember the Nawab who's now negotiating on behalf of the Persians. Sa'adat Khan wanted this position for himself. So Sa'adat Khan went back to Nadir Shah, saying he'd been played by Nizam-ul-Mulk and the Mughal Emperor. Sa'adat Khan told Nadir Shah that he could have easily gotten 10 times more than what they'd agreed upon. When Nadir Shah heard that, he promptly raised his demand to 200 million rupees. Nadir Shah and the Mughal Emperor, who was essentially his captive now, entered Delhi in early March 1739. The following Friday, the khutbah, the Jumu'ah sermon, was read in Nadir Shah's name and coins were struck bearing his name. This made Nadir Shah the first foreign invader since Babur to enter Delhi. Now, as it happened, the city was also preparing to celebrate Eid al-Adha. Eid al-Adha is one of the two universally accepted Islamic holidays. There are other holidays, but not everybody accepts them. Nadir Shah allowed his troops to go into Delhi to participate in the Eid al-Adha celebrations. However, he insisted they go in small groups to prevent them from looting or causing any trouble. Well, during the Eid festivities, a brawl broke out between the Persian soldiers and some local shopkeepers. The brawl turned into a riot, which quickly spread throughout the city. Throughout the day and on into the night, locals attacked and killed Persian soldiers. The next day, the 11th of March, 1739, an angry Nadir Shah went to Chandni Chowk, the scene of the worst rioting. Chandni Chowk means Moonlight Square and is one of the oldest markets in India. Nadir Shah climbed the stairs of the Masjid of Roshan-ud-Dowlah and unsheathed his sword. And with that signal, his soldiers began killing, raping, looting, and destroying everything in sight. Listen to this description of the slaughter. That in the calamitous night of the 11th Zulhijjah, on the spread of false report that Nadir Shah had died of cholera, the idle vagabonds and mischief makers of the city rose and killed about 1,000 Mughals of Nadir Shah. That the Shah, in great grief and wrath, entered the mosque of Roshan-ud-Dowlah, the deceased, situated near the Kotwali Chabutra, and issued orders for a general massacre of the citizens of the capital as a punishment for their misdeeds. That the bloodthirsty and men oppressing Mughals killed about 80,000 men and women, old and young, big or small of Delhi. That the slaughter and plunder of goods and properties worth lakhs and crores and the burning of shops and residential houses of bankers and merchants lasted till midday. A contemporary correspondence describing the events at Delhi at the time of Nadir Shah's invasion. Sayyid Hassan Askari, Proceedings of the Indian History Congress, Volume 10, 1947. Now, this article states about 80,000 people were killed. Other sources I've seen put the estimate around 20,000 to about 40,000 deaths. Eventually, Nizam-ul-Mulk went to Nadir Shah and begged him to stop the killing. Nadir Shah relented and resheathed his sword, that is, he put it back into his scabbard, and the violence stopped immediately. However, other sources state that it took several hours for the entire Persian army to finally stop fighting and looting as they were spread throughout the city. Amidst all the chaos, Sadat Khan, the guy who started this whole thing and got the tribute increased, he died. Some reports say he died from an injury he sustained in the battle. Others say he died from natural causes or an illness. And yet others say he drank poison and committed suicide out of grief for the damage he caused to Delhi. With the killing over, Nadir Shah's troops looted all the wealth from the Delhi fort that had been amassed since the time of Babur. This included the Peacock Throne, an extravagant, jewel-encrusted throne designed by Emperor Shah Jahan. We discussed this gaudy throne in the previous season, episode 9-5. Finally, Nadir Shah began his journey back to Persia in early May 1739. On his way back, he stopped in Punjab to say farewell to the governor, Zakaria Khan. At the governor's request, Nadir Shah agreed to release all of the captives he had in his possession. The Persians left behind a devastated and broken Mughal empire. The Mughal treasury and capital city had been looted, and they still had to pay the original 200 million rupees that Nadir Shah had demanded. And the emperor had ceded all lands west of the Indus River to Nadir Shah. This included all of Afghanistan and about half of Pakistan. Meanwhile, the Deccan and Bengal and Awadh were effectively autonomous states. As you can see, little by little, the Mughal Empire was falling apart. In the next episode, inshallah, we'll discuss how Bengal became autonomous as well as the rise of the Durrani state in Afghanistan. For those of you with young kids, I know how tough it can be to teach them Islamic history. Kids just want to play, right? But alhamdulillah, some amazing Muslim creatives have made it easier. They've developed a fun game called Time Hoppers, where kids travel through the golden age of Islam, learning about Muslim scientists and scholars. They even worked with historians to make sure it's accurate. You can download it for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. And be sure to check out MuslimKids.tv for more fun and educational Islamic content, including a high-quality 3D animated version of Time Hoppers coming soon, inshallah. Use coupon code IslamicHistoryPodcast, all one word, all lowercase, for 20% off an annual subscription to MuslimKids.tv. Spread the word. You've been listening to the Islamic History Podcast, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. You can support the Islamic History Podcast and get exclusive content by subscribing to our premium channel, Islamic History Exclusive. If you're an Apple or Spotify user, open the app and search for Islamic History Exclusive. If you're listening on Podbean, become a patron in the app and you'll get access to our premium content. You can also join by visiting patreon.com/Islamic History. I'd also like to thank Brother Zulfikar Sarosh for his research on the Mughal Empire and his continued support of the show. And thanks to all of our premium subscribers. Be sure to join the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group where you can download a copy of today's transcript. Finally, subscribe to the Islamic History Podcast YouTube channel for our video documentaries. Stay tuned for a short clip from the latest season of the Umayyad Caliphate. Until next time, my name is Muttaki Ismail for the Islamic History Podcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. During this conversation between Hayyan al-Nabati and the other Mawali, the other non-Arabs, he reportedly said, since the Arabs were not fighting for Islam, there was no reason for the Mawali to support them and let them kill each other. This says something very significant. This gives us some significant insight into the mindset of the Mawali. Now, once again, they're mostly Turkic or Persian, but I believe they're predominantly Turkic just because of the region that they were in. But this means that these Mawali, these non-Arabs, were Muslim. They had accepted Islam, and they were willing to fight and die for Islam, but they were not happy with Arab domination over them and their lands, or more specifically, they weren't happy with the Umayyad domination over them. One of Waqi's rivals, that is the leader of the Arab tribes in Khorasan against Qutaybah, one of Waqi's rivals informed Qutaybah that the soldiers were giving him allegiance. The soldiers were giving Waqi' allegiance. However, one of Waqi's friends met with Qutaybah, encountered this, and said this wasn't true. He said that he and Waqi' often got drunk together. He admitted to the governor they often drank alcohol together and said that Waqi' was at this moment at his home in a drunken stupor. This says so many things about leadership at that time. It means that, first of all, Qutaybah was not enforcing Islamic rules because, you know, he just didn't care that other people were drinking, getting drunk under his authority. And also that evidently it was not uncommon for people to get drunk in this region. Something different, how we learned earlier that the governor in Medina had been whipped for drinking wine when he was in Medina. Now, of course, the status of Medina and the status of Khorasan are completely different. Medina was the home of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam in his burial area, the burial place of the Prophet and many of the companions, of course. And also Khorasan was still, even though the Umayyads, the Arabs, controlled this region, Khorasan, which is essentially Central Asia, Khorasan was predominantly non-Muslim. It was a Muslim Arab minority ruling over a Turkic, Sogdian, mostly pagan, non-Muslim majority. Maybe with some Persians in there as well, but mostly Turkic and Sogdian. And Sogdian, from what I understand, is just another form of another branch of the Turkic family. Anyway, so I get that there is a difference in mentality, but still a lot of insight you get from these little comments that they make. Anyway, so back to the story. Now at first Qutaybah thought that this might just be two rivals hashing it out. Now remember, the first person who had reported that Waqi' was accepting allegiance from the soldiers was a rival of Waqi', whereas Waqi's friends, you know, said that was a lie and that it wasn't true. So Qutaybah wasn't sure what to believe, but he still decided to send a spy into the movement to infiltrate the movement and discover the truth. The man he sent was named Dirar Adabi, who was actually the guy that Qutaybah had replaced Waqi' with as the leader of Banu Tamim. Just a quick refresher. Remember, we said earlier that the reason Waqi' was willing to accept the leadership of the rebels against Qutaybah was because he had a grudge against Qutaybah for removing him as leader of Banu Tamim. Well, this guy, Dirar Adabi, was the guy who Qutaybah had replaced Waqi' with as leader of Banu Tamim. Well, Dirar Adabi, he went to Waqi', he pretended to swear allegiance to Waqi', and he was able to infiltrate the movement, and he found out that, yes, there are indeed soldiers allying with Waqi', and he sent this information back to Qutaybah. So now Qutaybah realizes that there is a rebellion fomenting under his watch, and he's just becoming aware of it. So he sent a messenger to Waqi', ordering Waqi' to come and meet him, appear at the palace. Waqi', who knew that this was a trap, that as soon as he got there, he'd be arrested and probably killed, or at least thrown into prison, Waqi' refused to comply. He made up some story about him being sick or disabled or something like that. Well, Qutaybah was not going to accept this excuse, and he sent armed horsemen to arrest Waqi' and gave them orders to behead him if he did not obey their orders. However, after the first messenger came and asked him to, well, ordered him to come to the palace, Waqi' knew the jig was up and he was ready for it. He sent word out to the men who had supported him to come to his aid, and they quickly came before the horsemen could arrive.